I think a word of appreciation from Carolyn and I to Steve. Steve pioneered this crazy project, you know. I think it's really important at Dallas Seminary that we fill the mind, but we also nurture the families. Because without a unity of the family, their ministries will be curtailed. And so to see the children playing, hear their voices, watch the moms, you know you're getting old when you like to watch kids. And we do, but a special thanks to Steve. He made it possible, really, and all of us have made it possible. Mention was made about the movie The Exodus, Charlton Heston, or I guess it was called Ten Commandments. We should watch that, but Carolyn and I have a problem with watching it. We can't get the video to work. We called our genius grandson, but he didn't return the call. But we're going to work on it. But I do recommend it. It's sort of a fictionalized Moses, but really wonderful. I think a lot about what we should do in our class, how to organize our time, and what to think about. And I kept coming back to Exodus. We have spent time, obviously, in the New Testament, in the Gospels, in some of the epistles, Hebrews, Revelation. And I thought, this is sort of pretty narrative literature and worth our reflection. So I thought, well, let's give it a try. So if you look at our notes, Exodus, it really, when you think of Exodus, it really has four parts to it. The redemption of God's people, that's chapter 1 to 18. The covenant with God's people, that's the Ten Commandments and the law. That's found in 19 to 21. Is that right? No, 31. And then the breaking of that covenant and the renewal of it, 32 to 34. And then the giving of the tabernacle, instructions for the tabernacle, takes five whole chapters, 35 to 40. When you think about the book, it's just rather amazing. So here we go. This is all introductory today. Conservative scholars, obviously, are of the opinion, and I think rightly so, that Moses composed the book of Exodus. I think he composed Exodus and Leviticus at Mount Sinai. Perhaps Numbers on the journey to the plains of Moab, and certainly Deuteronomy on the plains of Moab before the Lord took him away. When you look at the Old Testament, it seems to bear witness that Moses wrote it. Obviously, this man is trained in the best of educational institutions in Egypt. He is the son of, he's the adopted son of Hatshepsut that we'll come to. He is actually in line to be a pharaoh, but the Bible tells us that he chose rather to suffer with the people of God. For instance, David charged Solomon in the laws and requirements as written in the law of Moses. Ezra reads from the law of Moses. So I really think, and Moses wrote it. Jesus quotes from several passages in Exodus. And when he does, he often says, "And Moses said." So I don't think that is much of a debate in our circles. The date of the book is a debate. And the locus of that debate is the occurrence of a word And that word is a noun. It's Ramses the second. The Bible doesn't say Ramses the second, but it would be Ramses the second. If Ramses the second were the author, dates the book for us, it would be in the 12th century, about the end of the 1300s, beginning of the 1200s, if that were true. So you have a problem. My argument will be simply that the book was written, no, the Exodus occurred about 1445. The basis of that is that if you turn to 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, or 2 Kings 6, 1, it says that in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, which would be about 986, it says 330 years after, no, I got to get this right. 430 years after the Exodus, Solomon, in his fourth year, commenced to build the temple. So it would seem to me that we're better off by saying, and I think it's valid, that this book or this great event occurred in 145 BC. Now, the title, English titles are assigned normally by the author of the work or a prominent figure in the work. So 1st and 2nd Samuel, Samuel, although we do not think Samuel wrote it. Job is named Job, principal author or figure. So, but the Hebrew way of naming things is by the first two or three words of the book. So the Exodus is named for the great event of chapter 12, but the Hebrew would call it simply and the names, the first three words, or Bereshit bara Elohim, in the beginning, Genesis 1:1. That's how it would be called. So this is all just preliminary. What is the contribution of the work? Why is this work important? And I think, simply put, it's a picture of the Christian's life. And Tom quoted that passage in Corinthians 10 that the Old Testament was given to us as a pattern of life. So when you look at this book of Exodus, it begins with bondage, screaming bondage, and then triumph by miracle. Through the shedding of blood, the people of God are spared and they're taken out of their bondage. And they're now on a journey, 3 months to Sinai, a year in Sinai, 40 years in the wilderness, to reach the promised land. I think that's us. We have been delivered out of an enormous bondage by the sheer grace of God. We have been placed now into a wilderness, but it's a wilderness with a purpose. We are making our way to an allegorical Jordan. And many old hymns talk about heaven as crossing the Jordan River. It's a picture. So far, so good. So it's going, I think, so what you have in the book, simply put, is bondage, triumph, progressive walk with God, characterized by incessant unbelief, but God bringing us back. That's going to be the story. It's that simple. The context, obviously, if you want to know the context of Exodus, you turn to Genesis 46, because it has to do with Jacob. What we know is this: the lash of necessity called starvation convinced Jacob, after two visits by his sons, that Egypt was the place to go. So he goes to Egypt with his sons. Our text says 70 people. Stephen, in his sermon, says there were 75 that went to Egypt. How do you square the differences? We also know that from Abraham, chapter 15, that Abraham prophesied that the people would go to bondage and be in bondage for 430 years and then be delivered. Okay. And I put a bunch of dates in there that we don't need to rehearse. We all know this, that Joseph died. And one of the themes in this book is tragedy, but the work of God goes on. People die, but God's work continues. So the ancient patriarchs died. Time elapses. And then our Bible tells us in chapter 1, verse 7, we'll come to it, that a Pharaoh emerged that did not know Joseph, did not know the contribution he made in saving the Egyptian nation and his people. Why? Well, I think we're all prone to forget. But when you study it historically, what we know is this. After Joseph died a century later, Egypt was invaded by the Hyksos, a Semitic people, who had advantages technologically. They had the chariot. They had a crossbow that was superior to the weaponry of the day. And they conquered the Upper Nile River Valley. And they held that for 150 years. That's why, and after that, an Egyptian emerges and salvages the nation. His name is Thutmose the First. So if the Hyksos invasion ends about 1750, Thutmose comes, there's that enormous lapse of time. And they just forgot Joseph and his contribution. And that's where our text begins. It's sort of relatively pretty if you have a sense of humor. So let's look at the text. Here we go. This is really pretty. Chapter one is sort of doom and gloom. It's happy in a way, but it's doom. The background to Exodus is found in verses 1-7. Now, these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. Remember, Jacob's name is Israel as well. They came each one with his household. So this would have happened centuries before, 400 years before. And then he names them, which is interesting. The first six are children of Leah, Jacob's first wife. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, the first six. The seventh one is the child of Rachel. She will have two. Benjamin and Joseph. Joseph will be sold into slavery at 17. At the age of 30, he'll emerge as second in priority in rulership in Egypt. So he will languish 13 years in prison, and we know that truncated story. Dan and Naphtali are the children of Jacob's concubine Zilpah. And Gad and Asher are the children of Bilhah, 12 in all. So far, so good. So he's just setting the context rooted in the greater list in Genesis 46. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number. But Joseph was already in Egypt. Joseph was in Egypt. His two sons were in Egypt, born of Pharaoh's daughter, which gave Moses a right to the throne. By that time, it's Thutmose III. Thutmose, Thutmos, Moses. Remember when Hatshepsut, we'll come to her, named him. What did she name him? She named him Moses. Why? Because I took him out of the river. Moses. Now, what's significant about the Nile River? It was worshipped as the god Ra. It's the breadbasket of Egypt and the world of that day. In other words, my son, like all the other pharaohs to be, are deity. He came from Ra, Moses. So it's really a fun, scary thing. 70. Well, Joseph's two boys were born in Egypt, so they didn't go there. Joseph didn't go. He was already there. He got a free ride down to Egypt on a camel. And two sons of Judah are born in Egypt. So 70 and 75, I don't think conflict. We can work around that. Joseph died. Huh? Remember? I always think Xerxes the Great did die, and so must you and I. And all his brothers, and all that generation. Generation is a word meaning turning. So sometimes in the Bible, you read that the Exodus, the confinement in Egypt was 400 years. Other texts will say it's 430, but the word generation means turning. Four turns. All right. Hebrews weren't as specific with numbers as we are. But here's the old but. The sons of Israel were fruitful. There's four words here that really jump out at you. They were fruitful, they increased greatly. Ooh, they multiplied. They're like mice. They're like our couples in Swindoll Tower. And became exceedingly mighty. Why is he piling up all of this data for us? Simply put, why did Thutmose III hate Moses? Well, he was in line to be Pharaoh too. But more than that, they had been invaded for 150 years by the Hyksos. They throw out the Hyksos. But when they throw out the Hyksos, they discover a people in the land now larger than they are. So they're afraid of them. The text says they're afraid of them politically. So if another invader comes into the land and we have a Semitic people already there, will they not side with the invader and take our land? So the Jews are looked upon as a political threat to the empire. And you know it, because when they decide to do something about this growing population ratio, they enslave them, but they enslave them to build two cities. Those two cities were fortress cities that protected invasion from the east, where all invaders came. So Egypt has emerged as a nation from the thumb of the great Hyksos Empire. But now in the land, they are threatened by a people who are growing and growing and growing. So the question is, how do we stop this? How do we manage this for the sake of the hegemony of our future? That's what's going on in this book. Now, verse 8. So basically, verses 1 to 7 tells us all the background. Verse 8. Now, a new king arose over Egypt. Who is he? Dating is tricky. I worked on it hard, kept changing it 3 times. I sent the same notes for copying, correcting them 3 times. Egyptian, it's kind of hard to date. Now a new king arose over Egypt. Who would that be? Who's the new king? Thutmose the first. By the time you get to the Exodus, it's Thutmose the third, who did not know Joseph, didn't know the contribution of the Jewish people, but simply saw them as a potential enormous political threat. So what are you going to do? And this sets the stage for the great Exodus. Well, you're going to deal with them. How do you deal with these people? Well, really, the more they tried, the more they lost. But they did 3 things, and that's the rest of our chapter. 1, they enslaved them. They sent them off to work in distant places. But that didn't work. So they thought these husbands would go home tired, turn on the TV, and go to sleep. Didn't work. So what then did they do? They contacted 2 midwives and said, when a male is born, kill him. Let the girls live. In other words, within a generation, the nation would be lost to the pages of history. When that didn't work in a humorous fashion, they said, throw every male born child into the Nile. Kill it. In other words, they're blaming it on their god Ra, not themselves. The Nile kills these children. This is exciting to me. So here we go. He said, this Pharaoh, to his people, behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more mighty, are more and mightier than we. What's he dealing with? Fear. Fear. Come, let us deal wisely with them. Some texts say prudently, or else they will multiply, and in the event of war, there it is. What do we do to the Japanese on the West Coast in the beginning stages of World War II, when some thought we'd be invaded? We placed them in isolated camps. We got them out of the way, good or bad. Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply, and in the event of war, they will join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and then depart from the land. We got a problem. So I can sympathize with the Egyptians, right? That didn't work. That's what they were doing. Verse 11. So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor, right? And we have the story of that hard labor. They build buildings. They work in the fields. And they built for Pharaoh storage cities, 2 of them. And in the 5th page, I put a little map of the land of Goshen. The Nile flows into the Mediterranean Sea, not from it. And at where it approaches the Mediterranean, it then fractures into tributaries. And that is the land of Goshen, south of Alexandria, 20 miles north of Cairo. They built two cities. One they named Ramses, and the other Pithon. They are storage cities. They are royal cities. They are fortresses. So they're not only dealing with the population, they're using this fearful population for their own protection. So it makes sense. And they built storage cities, Ramses and Pithon. But now, why did they call it Ramses if Ramses doesn't appear on the scene for another 200 years? They named it for Ra, their god. Ra is a common word in that culture. Now, but there's always a but in life. The more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied. So slave labor is not wearing out these young guys. And the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. So plan one, enslavement, just simply doesn't work. So now we have to get more creative. Oh, I should have read verse 13. And the Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks and of all kinds of labor in the field, and their laborers, which were they vigorously imposed upon them. So they're clamping down. But that didn't work. And so they opt into a two-part theory. It's called ethnic cleansing. We will destroy the male population. First, we'll get the Jews to do it themselves. Then, the king of Egypt, Thutmose, I think the first, spoke to the Hebrew midwives. Now, there has to be more than two midwives. I mean, they go into the land, 70. They come out of the land with an army of 600,000. Not counting women and children. So it's estimated when they finally come out between 2 and 3 million people. I don't know what to do with all that group. So it tells me that two midwives can't service all these crazy families. But he picks, maybe they're the ringleaders of the society. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiprah, and the other, Pua. And here's the instruction. When you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birthing stool, a chair, if it is a son, then you are to put him to death. But if a daughter, she shall live. So it's fairly clear. Verse 17. But the midwives feared God. So what one of the lessons in Exodus is we should fear God more than we fear negative circumstances. In Exodus, ladies are heroes. And now we face two of them. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. Well, you know what's going to happen. The Pharaoh is going to come back and say, what's wrong here? And this is really beautiful. The midwives said to Pharaoh, well, I should read the upper voice. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and let the boys live? And the midwife said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women. Okay? Really? In other words, when it comes to birthing, these Israelis are slick. But the Egyptians are slow. And by the time we get to the house, the child is already born. Are they lying? I think so. Which tells me that it's not always wrong to lie when there's a greater issue at hand. So I think we would say, I hate to talk like this, we're hierarchicalists. It is better to obey God than man. Not often do these tragedies come, but they often come. Holland, do you have a Jew in your house? No, but you know you do. Hiding under your bed. That's all right. In other words, when you are asked to do something that the Bible strictly prohibits, you are not wrong in lying. But you got to make sure that it's not a habit. Now, the midwife said, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife can get to them. In other words, I think the midwives move slowly. They figured it out. In other words, it's not working, theoretically. So God was good to the midwife, these two valiant ladies. And the people multiply, the word multiply and mighty and numerous all through this chapter. So in the midst of enormous adversity, there is enormous prosperity. Right? It always goes together. Because the midwives feared God second time. They feared him. He established households for them. Well, okay, this midwife thing is not working. So what do we do now? Verse 22. Then Pharaoh commanded his people, saying, every son who is born, you are to cast into the Nile. You are to give to Ra. And every daughter, you are to keep alive. Okay? So I think Exodus chapter 1 is the great setting. Egypt has come out of Hyksos domination. And they are fearful that when the next invasion comes, a Semitic people in the land might side with them. So they go about dealing with them. First, they try slave labor to wear them out and wear them down, but it doesn't work. Then they command midwives, but they fear God. And they make up an excuse. And God blesses them for their faith. And then it comes down to the average Egyptian. When you see a Hebrew child, you are to throw it in the Nile. Now, there's a humorous side to this. Moses' parents, next chapter, throw their son in the Nile. So they did what they were commanded. But they threw him in the Nile in a basket. And Hatshepsut, we'll talk about her next time, finds this child. And when she opens this little basket, Moses smiles at her and cries. And this dear lady's heart, she's known for her kindness in Egyptian history, her heart just melts. And she says, I love this child. And standing a little bit away is his older sister, Miriam. And Miriam comes over and says, need any help? So he says, yeah, I need someone to nurse this child, my son. And she lifts him out of the water and calls him, Moses, out of the water. Gives them to Miriam, who gives them to Jacob, raising the child. Now, weaning took between 18 months and 5 years in that culture. What does that tell me? It tells me of the enormous importance of those first few years of child training. When they're in your home, they are shaped in those early few years. So whatever length of time of the nursing it was, Amram and Jacobed instilled in that child deep convictions. And when he was 40, in spite of an enormous education and the prospect of being a Pharaoh, he turned his back on it to side with his people. They taught him his people and his God. And though a child of five or something, he never forgot it. Isn't that pretty? So I think one thing I've learned is those hard years are all worth it in shaping a child's life. So what do we learn quickly? One, Israel's abject condition is a picture of our condition. We're slaves to sin. Fear often prompts harsh reactions. I can understand the Egyptians if you're under the thumb for over 150 years. You have paranoia. God, in his great providence, protects his people. Isn't that pretty? He kept these little guys alive. The fear of God is of greater value than the fear of people. God blesses obedience. Isn't that pretty? And then I say this. A day is composed of a period of light and a period of darkness, though it makes for a single day. Why did God do that? I think he did it to teach us that after darkness comes light. And in this life, the darkness sometimes returns, but light always returns. There is an important lesson here for all of us that can be seen in our passage. There was the dark night of oppression and destruction imposed by tyrants. And yet simultaneously, the bright sunshine of God's protection and believers who are willing to act in obedience to him. After darkness comes light. That's true for all of us. It is a truism. What are you doing to live in the light when your day may be dark? You look forward. You look forward to another day, and you look back to the promises of God. It will not always be this day. Isn't that pretty? So the story is a picture of you and me. We have been delivered from, we were in bondage, chapter one, but God didn't leave us there. He sent us the true Moses. And by blood and miracle, his own blood, we have been delivered. And now you and I walk in the wilderness. At Sinai, we were given the instructions of how to express thankfulness. And now we're making our way to cross over the allegorical Jordan into the land of promise. Does that make sense? It's just a beautiful story. More than that. So far, so good. Let's pray. Thank you, Father, for the Bible. Thank you for disclosing your mind to us, never completely, but assuredly. And you have filled the Bible with events in the past to give us a tradition, to give us our history. Pray that in our day, we may be faithful too, as we trudge, often unfaithfully, but trudge toward the promised land. We give this week to you. We give those in our class who carry burdens, known and unknown, those who suffer from ill health of one type or another, those who suffer from quiet loneliness. There's many things, but we are a family. We look forward to the day when we will be together, where there'll be no more darkness, no more tears, no more fear. We'll be in your presence forever and ever. And we offer to your Son our praise. Amen. Thank you.